start from the beginning of the Sedra. The Sedra starts Zos Chukas HaTorah. You're aware that Chukim are the kinds of laws that are super rational. They're beyond rationality. Like Poraduma, what's the word, meaning how a person becomes Tomei by being in the close proximity with a person who's dead, and how the sprinkling of the ashes of the Poraduma right, make a person Tahor is something else, something that's beyond rationality. And then there's Mishpatim. Mishpatim are rational laws, like don't murder, don't steal, and so on. The truth is that Zos Chukas HaTorah tells us that really the whole Torah is a chok, meaning that even the Mishpatim that have rational ideas behind them, like murder, that's only in the black and white areas. You go over and shoot somebody's brains out, it's obviously not, it's rationally wrong to do. But on the other hand, the gray areas of murder, which the Torah considers murder in many cases, are not so rational. For instance, mercy killing. I could make a nice rational case for someone who's 119 years old, suffering terribly, wants to be put out of his misery, and he begs for somebody to give him an overdose of morphine so he can die peacefully. I could hear a rational argument for that, except you're not allowed to do it. It's murder in most cases. Abortion. I could hear a rational reason, and many rational people who argue that abortion should be okay. Can't say it's irrational. It's awesome, because in most cases, the exceptions also, we're not Catholics. There are cases where abortion is mutter too. But even where it's a mitzvah to do, to save the mother's life. But in any case, there the gray areas are not necessarily rational. The same thing goes with chukim. And that is that even though paraduma, which is the chok par excellence, because there's a part of paraduma that is really seems to be irrational. It on the one hand makes people who are seriously tamei tahar, somebody who is tamei, right, spiritually impure because he came in contact with the dead, the aper of the paraduma, sprinkling the ashes of the paraduma mixed with the spring water and other ingredients makes that person pure, and the person who does the sprinkling becomes tameh. So it's metame tahori, it makes tameh people who originally were tahor, and it's metayer tameyim, and it makes people who originally tameh tahor. So it seems to be not rational. But even paraduma has an idea behind it. There's ideas behind the idea of paraduma. So I want to mention to you a possible understanding of how paraduma works and why it in fact makes people who are pure impure and vice versa. And why these ashes are metaher, a person who comes in contact with the dead. First of all, the Medrash says very clearly, Lo hames metame. It's not that the it's okay. My wife provided for me and I had a nice little meal before. Thank you. Shukar. Baruch Ato Adonai Elohim Melech Olam Shakol Mir Baruch. Thank you, what's good. Okay. The Medrash says, Lo hames metame, it's not that you catch tuma from a dead body. You don't become tame because the mace has radiates some kind of impurity that you catch from the mace, not contagious. So that's not how you become tame. The low afer metayer, and it's not the ashes of the paraduma that make you tahor. They don't have some kind of magical thing that removes impurity. Elechok chokati. God said, I made a law. It's the law that I made that has the effect. Now let me explain how I think that works. And again, this will not explain all of the details of Parah Aduma, because ultimately it's a chok. Ultimately it's something that's beyond our rationale. And even, it says, Shlomo HaMelech didn't understand Parah Aduma. There were areas that were beyond his understanding. There's only one human being that the ideas of Parah Aduma were revealed to completely, was Moshe Rabbeinu. In any case, so, but an idea can be the following. Why, what is Tumah? Tumah is where there is a separation between spiritual and physical. More specifically, wherever there was a spiritual presence in a place and it left, the vacuum that's left is either Tumah or it fills with Tumah. One of the two. But the Tumah basically is the absence of a certain kedusha that existed in the place. For example, the obvious example is, a person was living, he had a neshama, which is a spiritual side of it. The neshama left a physical body. The vacuum that's caused by the neshama leaving is tumah. Now why? Why does that create tumah? Why does a spiritual entity leaving a place, separating between physical and spiritual, why is that called Tumah? Tumah basically, what's the effect of somebody who's Tameh? He can't go into the Beis HaMikdash. He can't eat sacrifices or Truma or any other holy object. Beyond that, there's basically no effect if you're Tameh. We're all Tameh. In fact, we're all probably Tameh Nes. We've all come in contact with the dead. You've been at a funeral. You've been in the same room as a dead body, you're Tameh. And there's no way of becoming Tahar. You can go to a mikvah 1,000 times. You can blowtorch yourself. Still won't help, right? You're still going to be Tameh. The only way to not become Tameh is with the Afer of Parah Aduma. We don't have a Parah Aduma. So we're all Tameh Meis. And there's no effect. We're Tameh Meis. We can do everything except go into the Beis HaMikdash, go up onto the place of the Harabayis where the Azorah used to be, and we can't eat Karbanos, which we don't have anyway, and we can't eat Truma or Meiser or whatever. Those things not. Okay. But otherwise, we can do everything. No effect. What basically does Tumah affect? Tumah affects my ability to cleave and have a connection to spiritual things, to godliness. It causes a separation between me and God to a certain degree. Why? Because when I see that there was spirituality, ruchnius, in a place, and now it's not there and what's left is physical, I get the idea in my mind, even subconsciously, even on a soul level, that the physical world and the spiritual world can be separated. And if you can separate the physical world and the spiritual world, then you can separate God from the world too, because God is not physical. So if spiritual things and physical things can be separated, then God can be separated from the world. And I begin to think that the physical world can have an existence of itself. But it's not really true, because God never separates himself from the world, because if he did, the world wouldn't exist. The world only exists because God wants it to exist every second. So God never separates himself. And the truth is that there's never really a full separation between physical and spiritual. It just appears to us like that. But God is still involved with the body even after the soul leaves it. And not only that, there are spiritual parts of the body that still remain by the body even after death. So there's never a total separation between the physical and the spiritual. But when it appears like that, it upsets me spiritually. It upsets my mind subconsciously. And I begin to think that there can be a separation between physical and spiritual. There can be physical things that exist separate from the spiritual, which leads me to believe that the world can be separated from God. And that creates a separation between me and God. And therefore I can't go in the Beis HaMikdash, I can't eat Karbanos, because those things represent a total connection. And I don't have that connection anymore. Therefore, when I come into contact with the dead body, in the ways that the Torah says affects me, right? It's not the dead body that makes me Tameh. It's not that the dead body is radiating Tumah that I catch. But the Torah said that when you come in contact with the dead body, it affects your neshama. and you think, whether you know it or not, it's not even subconscious, it's on a neshama level, it upsets and imbalances your neshama and gives you the idea that the physical and spiritual world can be separated. And that separates you from God. Now you have to somehow get back and change that idea. What it changes the idea? The paraduma. The paraduma is a kapara for the cheta eger, for the sin of the golden calf, because that's exactly what they did by the golden calf. They thought that they could separate the influence that they needed in this world from God. We'll take it over. We don't need God to influence it. We'll create a, remember when we spoke about the sin of the golden calf, we said it was like a receiving station of spiritual powers. We're going to create that entity that will be separated from God. We'll decide how we want it to work, and we'll be the ones who create the relationship between the spiritual powers through this ego. We're separating from God. So it appears like you can create some physical thing, and you don't have to have connected to God. What is the kapara for that? The paraduma. The paraduma is the mother of the eagle. The eagle is a calf, the mother. Okay, and it's red because gold has a reddish hue to it. So the paraduma, the red heifer, is like the mother of the golden calf. Why the mother? So it says, I'll tell you another idea in a second, but it says that if a child goes to a party and he messes up over there and he throws up or whatever, who do you call to clean it up? His mother. Okay? So let the mother come and clean up the mess that her child made by the paraduma. What does that mean? I'll tell you in a second. But there's, what? Right, the chet ha'egel. What's the idea? What's the idea? Before we get to that idea, let me tell you a different one. And that is the following. We said that, this I think the Maharal says, we said that the whole idea of the chet ha'egel was the same idea as, and the chet ha'egel resulted in, what's it called, in death. Because when once they got the Torah, they weren't going to die anymore. And once they sinned by the golden calf, then death came back to the world. So death and the sin of the golden calf go together too. And the sin of the golden calf was a separation between the physical and the spiritual. That's what death is. Okay. And therefore, what will be the kapara to remember that even though it appears like the physical and spiritual separated, they're not really. They're still connected. Therefore, bring the mother. This calf didn't come by itself. It's not an entity to itself. It came from somewhere. Where did the calf come from? From a mother. Where did that mother come from? From another mother. Where did that mother come from? From another one. If you trace everything back to its source, what do you get to? The first cow. Who made the first cow? God. So everything still is connected to God. All you have to do is trace it back to its source. So by bringing the mother, you give yourself the understanding that even though this calf looks like a separation from God, it's not. Because if you trace it back to its source, you're going to come back to God. Everything is still connected to God, even that may appear differently. That's what it says, that's why you bring the mother. Why does the mother clean up for the kid? Right? Why do you bring the mother? Because a mother is so connected to her child that there's nothing the child can do that's disgusting to the mother. That's why you call the mother. Because even the father, right, not going to want to clean up. But the mother can do anything for a child. Why? Because it's part of her. So too, God never separates himself from us. Even when a person is dead, even when there's tuma, hashochein imam betoch, because God's like the mother. He is so close to the Jewish people. We're a chelik eloka mima, we're kibiyachol, part and parcel of God. There's nothing we can do that separates us from God. He's angry with us, he punishes us, but he never separates himself from us. So that is the lesson that you have to learn. You come in contact with the dead, it gives you, it imbalances your neshama, it jolts it. It looks like there's a separation between spiritual and physical, that separates me from God. And then take the paraduma, the mother of the ego, which brought about this feeling of separating physical, spiritual, which brought about death, and I trace it back to the mother, and realize that there's never a separation. No matter how bad, no matter how lowly, whatever, God's still there. just like the mother, it can always be with the child. And if you trace the child back, you'll always come back to another cause and another cause till you come to the first cause, which is God. Okay. Therefore, if somebody has a question, something's bothering him, and he has a question in emunah, right, a question in belief, and then you give him the answer to that question, okay, and now he's satisfied, he has a good answer to his question in belief, he now what? Becomes a believer again. Okay, what happens if the person had no questions? He had perfect belief. And you tell him, hey, you want to hear a good question? What have you done with that person now? Created a doubt in his mind, because he never thought of that question. Now you told him the question, so now he has a doubt in him. When a person had questions on God's connection to the world, and you presented him with the Paraduma, which answers his question on a spiritual, on a soul level, on a subconscious level, so now he's taught. His question's been answered. But somebody who didn't come in contact with the dead has no question. Now you're giving him an answer to a question he didn't have. What are you doing? You're creating the question in his mind. He becomes Tomei. The person who was Tomei had a question that needed to be answered. The Paraduma answers it. The person who was Tar had no questions. He had a very nice connection relationship to God. Now all of a sudden you're telling him, hey, don't think that there could be things that are separated from God or whatever. What do you mean? I never thought that to begin with. Now you've got it in my mind. Now you become Tumah. Not the same degree of Tumah, but a lesser degree of Tumah. That's why the Paraduma makes the person who's Tahar Tameh, and the person who's Tameh Tahar, based on this idea. Okay, go to something else. Another idea with the Paraduma is that it's sin that causes death. Wouldn't be that there would be sin, there wouldn't be any death, people wouldn't die. Doesn't mean we'd stay in this world forever, because that's the purpose of creation. But we would graduate to the world to come without having to die. Our bodies and souls would not be separated, but they would work on each other in a symbiotic relationship where the soul made the body more pure, and the body then made the soul more pure, because a more pure body can make the soul even more pure, and the more pure soul would make the body more pure, and it would go back and forth until both of them would be so purified and crystallized they would just ascend to the next level of existence in the spiritual world in the world to come without any death, like Eliyahu Navi, like whatever Chanoch, right? But death comes because of sin. Because there's sin, this process can't work, the Ramchal says, and therefore the body has to be separated and atoned for in its way, to go back to its elements, decompose, take out the sin, the result of the sins that affected the body. The neshama goes and gets its tikkun in Gehenna, in Gan Eden, whatever, where the neshama is purified, and then they're put back together again by Kriyas HaMeisim. But it's only sin that causes death. It wouldn't be for sin. It wouldn't be for the original sin of Adam and Chava. I hate to use that word. The sin of Adam and Chava, right, then there wouldn't be death to begin with. Had it not been for the sin of the golden calf, death would have been eradicated and wouldn't have needed it again. In any case, so the burning of the Paraduma represents how to get rid of sin. How? So the Paraduma itself, sin is represented by red. Something red, right? In Yuchatoech HaShonim, if your sins are crimson, right? Shonim, Katsemer Yud, they'll be light, they'll turn white like wool. On Yom Kippur, they used to hang up a crimson ribbon, and if the sins were forgiven, they used to turn to white. So red is a sign of sin. So we take a red cow, which is a sign of sin, okay, and we burn it. Burn it completely, right, get rid of it, okay? But there's some other ingredients also. One ingredient is an Eitz Eres, a piece of wood from a cedar tree. Because part of what causes sin is people are too haughty. They think they're too great. They don't think they need God. They can do whatever they want. So haughtiness causes sin. On the other hand, we also take a weed, a piece of hyssop, an azel, which represents something very lowly, because sometimes people sin because they don't feel important enough, because they feel nothing. They feel totally unimportant, have no self-esteem, so therefore what difference make what I do? I'm a nobody, I'm a nothing, so I can act like a nothing too. A person has self-respect and self-esteem, there are certain things that are beneath his dignity to do. But if you have no dignity, and you have no self-esteem, and you consider yourself a nothing, there's nothing beneath your dignity to do. So you do a lot of things that are unbefitting to a human being, but you don't feel that that you're anything special. So that doesn't stop you from sinning. So sin can be caused by somebody who's too haughty or too humble. So you take the eight eras and the azov, you burn that also. And then the shnitolas. Shnitolas is a piece of wool that is dyed. Okay. Why? Because that also causes sin. Sin comes either because people have a Yetzirah and they want to sin, period, or because they're so haughty they don't care, I'll do what I want, or because they're so lowly that they don't think that there's anything wrong with doing things that are unbefitting. There's nothing unbefitting me, because I'm nobody anyway. I'm an animal, so I'll act like an animal. But there's another thing that causes sin. Even for people who are not so haughty, and they're not so, lowly, and they're not people who have a tremendous Yetzer Hara and do sins, the Yetzer Hara has another ploy for even people like us, who don't fit into the other categories. Okay? What is that? The Gemara says that there's a Shaila, Shochet Mitnei Mamischayim. On Shabbos, one of the malachas is slaughtering. Okay, so what exactly is the malacha? Right? What was the malacha of slaughtering? What's the prohibition? So, Rav says mishum metilas neshama, mishum tzoveya. It's because of dying with a Y. When they slaughter an animal, they like the blood to go on the place where you sheft it, because it makes it look fresh, makes the meat look fresh. So you are dyeing the meat, coloring it. And Shmuel said, Mishum Netilas Neshama. You're killing the animal. And taking the life of the animal could mean taking the blood out of the circulatory system is called Netilas Neshama. You're taking the Neshama because the Neshama is in the blood. So taking blood out of a living creature is called Netilas Neshama. That's a Gemara. What does that do with anything? The Baal Shem Tov said there's an allegorical meaning to this Gemara. Shochet is a euphemism for the Yetzer Hara, the Satan. He is the Shochet. He is the slaughterer. Because the Yetzer Hara is the same one who then is the Malach HaMavis, right, the Shochet, and he's also the one who goes and testifies against you. So who ha Yetzer Hara? Who ha Satan? Who ha Malach HaMavis? So it says in the future, God is going to just slaughter the Yetzer Hara. He's going to get rid of him. So the question is, why? What did he do wrong? He's an angel. He was created to do his job. He did his job. Why is he going to be destroyed? Why is God going to shecht him? Shochet, the Yetzer Hara, who's called the Shochet, why is he going to be held guilty? What did he do wrong? He did what he was supposed to do. He was created to make us do sins. So Shmuel says, because in the Tilas Neshama, he does his job too good. He's supposed to do his job and try to tempt us, but not cause us to die. He's not supposed to be that successful. He's too successful. And therefore, he's going to be high. And Rav said, no, something else. If the Yetzer Hara would come to you and say, look, what's it called? I want you to not pay your bill by the grocery store. Okay. Why? Because I want you to, what's it called? You should benefit, and this guy should lose and steal from you. Okay? Don't pay your debts. Don't pay your bill. Then you have an even chance. The Yetzer Hara would say, you know, hey, if I invest a little bit more money, I can get more pleasure. And why should I give it to that guy? I'll keep it myself. And the Yetzer HaTov would say, no, you're stealing from the poor man. You bought the groceries, pay him. Then you'd have an even chance. But it doesn't come to you like that. He says, you know, this guy, he overcharges you anyway, right? And therefore, he stole from you. So if you don't pay your bill, you're just getting even, right? You're not stealing anything from him. You're not taking anything from him. You add up all the time that he overcharged you for things or whatever. He's making a big profit on you, right? So you deserve to take something back from him. Don't pay your debt. It makes it a mitzvah. Not only that, it's a mitzvah because I pay. I'm just going to encourage him to charge out from other people, overcharge them. So I'm helping other people. I'm doing a chesed by not paying my debts. That's how the Yetzer Hara works. Okay, in case you didn't know. He makes, right, Yeshiva Bacharim, I tell him, the Yetzer Hara doesn't come to you and say, stay in bed, forget about davening, what's it called, it's so nice to be in bed, and what's it called, sleep another hour, and say, the heck with davening. If the Yetzer Hara would come like that, you have an even chance. The Yetzer Hara would say, get up and daven, and the Yetzer Hara would say, forget about it, fine. It doesn't come like that. He comes and he says, well, look, you're going to get up now and go daven. You're going to be tired the whole day. So you're not going to be able to learn at all. Better sleep another hour. You'll daven anyway by yourself. You'll be well rested. You'll learn so much better the rest of the day. It's worth it. So the Yetzer Hara comes to you. You're doing a mitzvah. It's not an aveira anymore. Right? You're doing a mitzvah because you're really going to enhance your day by sleeping an extra hour. So he colors the aveira into something that it's not. So veira. He dyes it. Right? One says he's chayav because he makes you die. The other one is because he dyes the sin and makes you see it as a mitzvah and doesn't give you an even chance. For that, he's going to be chayav. So we take a dyed piece of wool, which is also a symbol of sin, because that's what the Yetzer Hara does. He dyes the sin and makes it look good, and therefore, what's it called? We burn that too. And then, it's not good enough just to not do anything bad. You have to do good things too. So we take all those ashes and we put them into living water, mayim chayim, right, into spring water, which is what a symbol of Torah. Torah is compared to water, especially living water. So you take the Torah, which is the positive, you have destroyed, burnt the negative, and that takes away tumas meis, that takes away this source of death, which is sin. Okay. Now that you understand paraduma, let's go on to the next one.
Why is the parasha right after Korach? What's the connection? Where is your connection?
Why right after Korach? Yeah. Why is Paraduma right after Korach? I don't know why it's after Korach, but I know why it's right before the next parasha of Miriam, because it says just like Paraduma is Mechaper, takes away Tuma, and because Tuma is dependent on sin, it's an atonement. The death of Tzadikim is also atonement. That's why right after that is Miriam's death, and after that is Aaron's death. To tell me that the death of Tzadikim, why it follows the parsha before, I'm not sure. Just as a possibility, as an extension of what we're saying, off the top of my head. What's in the end of last week's Shedra? Tzitzis. Yeah? That last week's Shedra? No, it's in Shlach. Forget it. Amaisat Matrumas, Kohanim. Right. That's good. The Kohanim. And we are that which connect the spiritual and the physical. They are our shluchim and God's shluchim. So they are the go-between between us and the spiritual and God. And the whole idea of paraduma is a separation between that. So there's a connection between kohanim and the opposite of that, and that's why a kohen can't become tamei. Because it's the antithesis of what a kohen is. So Tumas Meis and Kohanim, there's a connection there. Okay.
What?
Right, Korach comes after the Meraglim. Machlokas will show them when Korach happens. Ramban says after. Okay. That's when he found the time when they weren't going to Israel anymore that the people would listen to him against Moshe Rabbeinu. Okay. Okay, another thing that is interesting. It says that Moshe Rabbeinu was supposed to speak to the rock. Okay, God said, take your staff and go speak to the rock. And according to Rashi, the sin was that instead of speaking to the rock, he hit the rock with his staff. And had he not hit it, the people would have said, a rock which doesn't get rewarded or punished, and it does God's will without being hit, we certainly will get rewarded and punished and do God's will without having to be hit. But the fact that he hit the stone, so people didn't learn that lesson. Okay. What does that mean? Moshe Rabbeinu is supposed to go to a stone and say, "Stone, can we have some water?" Right? It's a little bit absurd. Right? What does it mean? What does it mean? The Dibartan Elasel. Says the Netziv, it doesn't mean to speak to the rock. It means the following. It means that in the Midbar, the first time around, when Miriam's well first came, at the beginning of the 40 years, God told him also to go and hit the rock. And he hit the rock and water came. Now he tells him, I don't want you to hit the rock, I want you to speak to it. So he said, according to Rashi, in the beginning, when the mentor says you have a kid, now he starts to learn, you got to hit him every once in a while to make him learn. He doesn't, not interested. But after 40 years of learning, you still have to hit the kid, something's wrong. Right? He should have matured enough to realize that he wants to learn. He doesn't have to be hit anymore. Right? It's 40 years at this doing it, he's already an established Talmud Chacham. He doesn't have to be hit to sit and learn. He should be enjoying it. It should be something he understands, the importance of it. So that's a simple idea. It says in the Tziv a different idea. He says in the beginning of the 40 years, they were in the desert. And in the desert, God dealt with them miraculously. You hit a rock and water comes out, it's a miracle. It's a miracle. That's the way things were supposed to be in the desert. But when they were going to come into Eretz Yisrael, it wasn't going to work like that anymore. Right? There weren't going to be open miracles. How would they get, if there was no water, they wouldn't come and say, get us water from a rock. What would they do when there's a drought? You daven, you fast, right? You say, give great Torah. It says that the people fast, they come out into the town square, and they say Divrei Torah and Tefillah, they daven and they say Divrei Torah and it rains, hopefully. They do tshuva and it rains. That's how you get it to rain in Eretz Yisrael. It says in the Tziv, when God is going to change his divine providence, how he deals with us, so he begins to change it slowly. In other words, we're almost ready to go into Eretz Yisrael. Okay? And God said, I want you to get a dry run. That's a bad pun. But in any case, I want you to get a preparation for how it's going to be in Eretz Yisrael. I don't want you to go and hit the rock like you did 40 years ago. Because that was for the desert. In Eretz Yisrael, not hitting the rocks to get water. You're going to dive in the terrain. So I want you to go to the rock. And it's going to be, not exactly, but it's going to be the beginning. It's going to be like a test. So the debark in El Asela, you and Aaron go, and you daven. Daven, El Asela means by the rock. Speak by the rock. What are you going to speak about? You'll speak Divrei Musar, so people should do tshuva. And you should speak daven. And Divrei Torah. And that's what you're going to do in Eretz Yisrael when there's no rain, when there's no water. So you're getting used to what's going to be in the future. It's going to change soon, so get used to it. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't realize that times have changed, and he hit the rock like he did the first time. And that's not what the Rav Shem wanted. He wanted the people to get to understand how the new order was going to be in Eretz Yisrael. Based on that, okay, that's the Mitzvah. Based on that, I want to say that if that's true, that whenever the Rabbanu Shem is going to change his relationship with us, right, the order of things, and a new order is going to come, then he makes a test beforehand. He sets a dry run. So I would think that that's what we're in the middle of now. Since the beginning of the 1800s, God has been making a dry run of what's going to be like in Mashiach comes. Let me explain. What's going to be the differences in God's relationship to us once Mashiach comes? A few things. First of all, there won't be any Shibud Malchios. We will not be subservient to the nations of the world. We'll be free. Okay? We'll have our own Malchios. We'll be able to be free and not subservient to the nations of the world. That's the first thing. Okay? That's Geula. We'll be redeemed. Second thing, we'll all be in Eretz Yisrael. Third thing, we'll have a Beis HaMikdash. Fourth thing, all Jews will be united together in one place, not scattered around the world. Those are the four things. Independence, a what's it called, Eretz Yisrael, Beis HaMikdash, unity of Jews. Four things. Now, think about it. Starting from around 1776, okay, there was a phenomenon in the world that never existed before that. And it was, to a certain degree, a bitl of Shibud Malchus. Not completely, but a taste of it. A dry run. Just like over here. It wasn't completely the same thing. It wasn't that it was going to rain or whatever. It was in between. What happened? America was founded. America is very different than any other country Jews were in, right, before that. Any other country, even if the guy treated us well, and they gave us rights, but they conferred the rights on us, and they could take the rights away. Meaning, even in England, right, besides the fact that England threw us out also for a while, right, but when we were there and we were treated well, but it was because the queen or king decided to treat the Jews well. So we were subservient to the government, but the government was nice to us. In America, that wasn't the case. It wasn't that the American government decided to be nice to Jews. They had this democracy. Democracy means that everybody has an inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It's inalienable. Inalienable means it's not conferred on you by the government. The government doesn't give you that. God gives you that. Okay? And therefore, anybody who lives in America, who's a citizen of America, has the rights, not because the government said you have the right, because the government recognizes that inalienable rights. So Jews weren't given rights any more different than anybody else. We all have the same rights. So that's not Shibud. It is Shibud Malchios, but it's not. Right? For all practical purposes, the government still tells you what to do. We're not independent. But it's different than it ever was before. So there was a taste of freedom. You could do what you want. Right? You're not under the thumb of a government, per se. Jewish-wise. Yiddish-type-wise. So God was testing us. It's going to happen when Mashiach comes, right? Which 200 years, 250 years in the the line of history is a few minutes. So God said, it's coming soon that you're going to be free completely. Let's see how you use the freedom. Here in America, you're free. Are you going to be free to serve me or free to run away from me? Some people are passing the test over there, and they built a tremendous Yiddishkeit in America, very strong, because we have equal rights with everybody else, religion, and they don't, what's it called, persecute religion. And some people have used it to be free of religion, right? To be free of the
Republic.
Most.
What? Most went that way.
Yeah, whatever. God doesn't judge by most or not. He judges by people who know better. I'm sure he judges on a curve. He grades on a curve. So the people who went away maybe didn't know any better, never had education. The people who are strong are very strong. So maybe the quality outweighs the quantity. I don't know. They didn't ask me to grade the papers. So some people are passing the test, some people are not. Hopefully more people are passing, at least quality-wise, than are failing. Okay. That was the first test. Second test. Second difference will be that we'll all be in Eretz Yisrael. So God said, okay, I'm going to give you back a little portion of Eretz Yisrael. Not the whole thing, a portion. Let's see how you deal with it. Right? For people who can, are you going to come and live in Eretz Yisrael? Do you appreciate it? Or are you going to stay in Chutz La'aretz and Eretz Yisrael is not all that important? Right? If I'm giving it back, how do you appreciate it? Secondly, people who live there, how do you use it? Are you going to use it properly or are you abuse it? Here again, some people are passing the test and some people are failing the test. Hopefully, more people are passing quality-wise than are failing. But that's part of the test. Third thing. So that happened in 1948. Then the Rav Amishim said, okay, let's get to the third part of this test. Third part is Mekomos HaKadosh. You're going to get back to Beis HaMikdash, whatever. Let's try a little sample test. Give you back the Kotel HaMaariv. Right? Not just an outside wall of the Har HaBayis. Not the Beis HaMikdash. How are you going to deal with it? Are you going to deal with respect? Are you going to turn it to a tourist attraction? What exactly are you going to appreciate it? Right? If you appreciate that one wall, maybe I'll give you the rest of the walls and everything inside. If you don't appreciate the one wall, why should I give you other things to abuse? I'm going to give you other makomos hakadoshim. I'll give you chevron, right? Marisamach Peira. I'll give you kever rochel, right? All the places that for a while we didn't have access to, and all of a sudden we got back the access. Okay, it's another test. Mashiach will come, you'll have all these makomos hakadoshim. How are you going to deal with them? You appreciate them, don't appreciate them, whatever. And the last thing is, all Jews are going to be together. Now that could be a very, very nice thing, or it could be disastrous. In fact, that's why at Rosh Chodesh Benchin, which we did last Shabbos, we say, who yigal oson the car of God should redeem us quickly, right? The kabbets nidachenu mi'arba kanfos ha'aretz, and part of the redemption is to bring all of the scattered Jews from all the four corners of the earth to Eretz Israel, and then we end chaverim kol Israel. Why? Because if God brings all Jews to one place and they're not chaverim kol Israel, we'll kill each other. Right? In fact, it says in the one of the Ibn Virga wrote a history called Shevet Yehuda. He lived right after the Spanish Inquisition. So he writes there that there were two Portuguese kings, and one of them had Jews in his province, and he wanted to get rid of them. So the other king said, I don't advise you to harm these Jews, because history has shown that whenever goyim try to harm Jews, they don't end up okay. So I don't think it's a good thing to harm Jews. It's not a skula. It's a skula to get punished. But I have an idea. You want to get rid of them? I'll tell you how to get rid of them. Put them all on an island. You have an island where you can seclude all the Jews. Take all your Jews and tell them they have to move to that island. And then tell them they have to pick leaders. They'll kill each other. You won't have any problem. He said, what's it called? Within days, there won't be any Jews left on the island. That's what he said. He said, they'll take care, they'll do your dirty work. Unfortunately, right, if Jews are not friends, then all Jews will be back in Eretz Israel. We know what's going to come from that. Right? Civil war. Right? We'll kill each other out. So therefore we say, when do we want all Jews to be brought back in Eretz Israel? When chaverim kol Israel. When they'll be friends. They won't be friends, maybe it's better to leave us scattered amongst the world. So therefore the last test is, okay, let's try a little kibbutz galios. Not going to be complete, but we'll bring Jews from Ethiopia, Jews from India, Jews from Morocco, Jews from Yemen, right? Even Jews from America, right? And all these Jews, all these different way out customs or whatever, everybody with their own kippus, right? Everybody has their personality, you know, what's it called? Brits are not the same thing as Americans, and hard to, you know, not the same culture at all. Surely Ethiopians are not the same culture as either of them, right? And Moroccans are not the same culture as Taimanim, and Taimanim are not, right? All really different. And the chance of there being an eruption is very great. So the Rebbe says, let's test it and see. Let's bring all these different kinds of Jews together, see how you deal with each other. If you can deal with it properly on a small level, then I'll bring it on a more grand scale. So this idea that the Rebbe Shalom tries out the new Hanhaga, like a test run, could be that the last 200 years he's been testing us in all these areas, and eventually either we're going to pass or fail, right? And then the Rabbanim will say, okay, now you're ready to go to the big thing of where it's going to now graduate to Yemos HaMashiach. Could be. I don't know. I'm not a Navi, but it seems to me like there's something to that. Yeah.
The
Holocaust in the middle, okay. Good question. I can't answer you off the top of my head. I don't know why I didn't take that into consideration. It could be that the Holocaust, whatever reasons there were for the Holocaust, which is really beyond anybody's understanding, but some of the results of the Holocaust were all these things. The results of the Holocaust were that many Jews who were under Shibud Malchios either went to America or to Eretz Yisrael. So it put the focus of Jewry in Eretz Yisrael and America, because that's where Jews now have to practice these things. And if they're in Europe, they're not practicing them. So that's not the reason why the Holocaust happened, but it's a result. And the same thing goes with the fact that we were able to have Eretz Yisrael partially is a result of the Holocaust. Had the Goyim not had that pity on us because of the Holocaust, right after, probably never would have agreed to let us have a state of Israel. As it is, they had Harot, you know, what's it called, but that was part of the dynamics of the thing. So it may be that in order to facilitate Okay, but I'm saying there could be that facilitated the other things, the other tests being taken. Okay, one short look. What's in short here? That's one last thing. Two minutes. We'll try to keep it within that. It says, "Al kein yomru hamoshlim bo cheshbo." So the simple meaning of the sentence is that Sichon, the king of the Amori, conquered Moab and took away their major city called Cheshbon. And we then conquered Sichon and took the city away from him. Had he not conquered Moab, that city would have been prohibited to us, because we were not allowed to fight with Moab or take any of their land away. But once Sichon took it, it got laundered by Sichon. It now became not Moab's property anymore, but Sichon's property. And therefore, we were allowed to take it.
No, we got this book.
Right. So, exactly. So now, the rabbis learned from that, though. So it says, Bo, Al-Kain Yomru HaMoshlin. The people, the rulers say, Bo, let's go now to the city of Cheshbon, which was conquered by Sichon. As long as it was owned by Moab, and was always under the threat of being conquered by Sichon, nobody wanted to build up the city. But now that the city has been conquered by Sichon, it's now in the hands of a strong king, it's not vulnerable, build up the city. Build the city up. That's a simple meaning according to some things. The rabbi said that there's a homiletic meaning. Al-Kain Yomru HaMoshlim, the people who control their Yetzer Hara, who rule over their Yetzer Hara, have learned already how to conquer the Yetzer Hara. There tell the people who haven't learned yet, Bo Cheshbon, Bo V'nase Cheshbono Shalom. You want to know how to conquer Yetzer Hara? Make the Cheshbono Shalom. Make the tally of the world. Schar Mitzvah Keneged Hefseda, the reward of a mitzvah opposite the loss that you have by doing it, and the punishment of an Aveira Keneged the benefit that you'll have from it. In other words, you have to make a Cheshbon in this world. You have to make a cheshbon. Okay. So, what's the connection, though, with the simple meaning? Right? Again, it's the city of Cheshbon that was conquered by Sichon. Go build it up now. What's the connection? I was thinking of many answers, many, many ideas, but one quick one now. That's the following. A person has to know there's more in this world than just how things appear on the surface. But there's also a cheshbon. What's going to come from it? What's going to be the result of all of this? Okay? Because when Sichon conquered Cheshbon, he thought he's just, you know, having a military victory. But the truth is that behind all of this was that God wanted him to have it so it could be taken away from him and the Jewish people should get it. Because if he didn't conquer it, we couldn't have it. Because we couldn't take it away from Moab. So there was a grander plan than just what was appeared on the surface. So too, if you want to fight your Yetzer Hara, you can't just look at the moment. Should I do this Aveira? Shouldn't do this Aveira? Should I do this mitzvah? Not do this mitzvah? But you have to make a cheshbon. You have to see what's the grander plan of all of this. What's going to be the result? Right? You may get a benefit from doing an aveira now, but what's going to be in the long run? What's going to come from it? What's going to be the loss in the long run? Right now you may enjoy yourself, but what's going to be long run? You can't just look what's in front of you now. You have to see what the far-reaching implications are. Just like Sichon, had he known what he was just a pawn in a thing, in a long-run thing. So you have to see history, you have to see the world in a much grander way than just what's right in front of you. If you see what's right in front of you, you may be tempted to do a sin because it's pleasurable. But if you look at the far-reaching implications, it may be in the long run you're going to suffer a lot more than you would benefit from the short term. Same thing with the mitzvah. Right now, the mitzvah may cost money. It may cost me time. I don't think it's worth it. But what are the grander implications? What's going to be from this mitzvah? What's going to be if you don't do it? And the impact may be so great that the few pennies or the few dollars that you have to spend now are irrelevant compared to what the greater impact is. So that's a connection to the simple meaning of the sentence. Just like the Sichon conquered Cheshbon, it wasn't just a military victory for the moment, but it had far-reaching implications in the history of the world. So too a person has to realize whenever he does something, he has to make Cheshbono Shel Olam, not just the Cheshbon of your immediate do or don't. What's the Cheshbon, what's the grander implication vis-a-vis the entire world, the entire history, the future, from your little action, and put it into the perspective of eternity and universality, then maybe you'll come to a different decision.